Hi, I'm Richard, the founder of 10 Adventures, and this is the 10 Adventures podcast. Each week, we talk to real people about real adventures as they explore this incredible planet we all live on.
Today on the 10 Adventures podcast, we're talking Patagonia, a destination that is usually pretty high up on most people's adventure travel bucket list. With us today is Zoe Taylor, co-founder of Walk Patagonia, a boutique adventure tour operator based in the charming town of El Chalten, just outside of Los Glaciares National Park. Hi, Zoe. How are you doing?
Hi, Richard. Nice to be in touch again.
We met 3 years ago or 4 years ago in Tuscany at a trade show, and I've always been really interested in how you ended up owning a tour operator in Argentina. So how does, you know, somebody from England end up co-owning Walk Patagonia?
Good question. Well, as a child, I was brought up in Latin America for a few years, in Mexico and other countries. So I've always both had contact with Latin America and with the Spanish language. When I finished university in the UK, I went to Japan for a couple of years. I realized that the Asians are lovely, but I prefer the Latin Americans. So I looked into working for a British travel company as a tour leader, and I started leading tours of British tourists in Latin America. I did that for about 3 or 4 years, and that's what brought me down to Patagonia. That's when I fell in love with the first mountain guide that was leading me on my very first trip in Patagonia here in Chalten. That was in 2005, and 16 years later, we're still together. We got married here, and life is pretty good down here.
Wow, what a story. You know, I'm interested, you know, growing up, you know, coming from England, now being Argentinian, you know, are there any culture shocks that, you know, you were in store for when you, you know, all of a sudden decided to make Argentina your base?
The crazy thing with life is that when you start living somewhere new, you don't really realize that you're going to be there for so long. Most times we all take a step in a different direction, or we go and live somewhere and we think, oh, I'll try it out for 6 months, a year. And suddenly that year turns into 2 and it turns into 15. I remember when I first lived here and, you know, life was still, Chalten was still quite basic and rustic, rough around the corner, so to speak. And I know that I wanted to go home every year and I would see family, I'd go to the doctors, and I'd kind of still lived in the UK in my brain. It's only after being here for a few years that you kind of realise that you have to accept that you live somewhere on a day-to-day life. I suppose I've been lucky that because I've always lived in lots of different places, I've kind of got used to having to, you know, go out and smile and make friends from the first day. It's never always that easy. Argentina, you get used to everyone being not on time. And, you know, being British, kind of to me, 9 o'clock is 9 o'clock. But the Argentinians do have the habit of drinking mate, the drink that you drink through a straw, from a gourd. And that's kind of part of the society that I like, because it's what you do to share and pass time with friends and groups of people. So I suppose in that way, Argentina is quite an easy country to, you know, to be accepted into and to live in. I think also, Richard, it's interesting that Argentina doesn't have quite so many indigenous groups as maybe Bolivia or Peru. So in a way, it is one of the easier countries in Latin America to move to and to live in. And in the same way, I think for people, you know, who go on holiday, Argentina, as apart from, like, you know, what you see, the cultural part, I think is a lot more similar to what we are used to in Canada or what I'd be used to in the UK.
It's funny you mentioned that, because I actually worked in Buenos Aires for a bit. And when I landed there, I was like, this is like Paris and London, and like everyone looks like they're Italian. Like it was so weird. And one thing that hit me was, you know, from my very first day at the office, like no one told me how Argentinians greet each other. And my boss, you know, planted 2, you know, kiss on each cheek. And I was like, what's this guy doing? And, you know, you realize, okay, this is just how you greet, but it really breaks down barriers. And, you know, again, sharing mate as well. Like it is a really easy, you know, it's a really warm culture, and it really is one where you get accepted really quickly because you have all these things where you're breaking down barriers. When I came back to Canada, I was like, everyone's so far apart from each other. Like, you know, we never get close, and you just realize how warm of a culture it is. For listeners that don't know a lot about Patagonia, can you share a little bit about the region? I think everyone knows the name or has an idea, but, you know, what is Patagonia, someone who's lived there for so long?
Well, I think it's always really interesting. I think it's worth pointing out right from the start. Patagonia is not a country, and it's not anything legal either in Chile or Argentina. It's basically the southern part of all of Chile and Argentina. It's debated where it really starts. Like the northern border of it is kind of like slightly debated. It's a bit grey. But basically, you could say kind of like from 500 kilometers south of Buenos Aires, from there would start Patagonia, and it'd be pretty much the rest of it all down. In Chile and Argentina, if it weren't for political borders, then really Chilean and Argentinian Patagonia is very, very similar. There's the Andes, of course, divide the two countries, which mean that it's a lot rainier from the weather that's brought across the Pacific, which means that Chile is slightly greener than maybe the Argentinian side of Patagonia. Most of the rainfall is actually in the Andes, which is where we're receiving like 5,000 millimeters of rain in the Andes, which is what's really creating the ice field in the middle. And then pretty much kind of from the Andes towards the Atlantic would be all steppe. Now, the steppe, I'm referring to a semi-arid desert-like landscape, very, very flat, very desolate, and very sparse population. I think Patagonia, to me, that's the geographical area of it. On a human geography side of it, I think it's interesting how, yeah, it's still very, very little populated. In our area of Santa Cruz, which is a province where Los Glaciares National Park is located, we are now just over one person per square kilometer. So we're not any more classed as a deserted area, but it still feels like it.
And then you have a unique experience. You know, you came to Patagonia, you know, leading trips and, you know, getting to kind of see the region from the eyes of tourists and as a tourist. And now that you live there and you've fallen in love with it, you know, for you, what makes Patagonia so special?
What makes Patagonia special to me is the expanse, the space that you will drive 2, 3 hours or 8 hours. You might not see a town. You won't see a petrol station. You might not see another soul. That to me is part of Patagonia. Another part of Patagonia is the weather. We all think of Patagonia with these howling winds. And yeah, it's the days of the howling winds that you can hardly breathe because the wind kind of blown into your mouth is too strong for you to really be able to breathe normally. To be going up a hill and to literally just, you know, be blown over, that you have to crouch down so that you're not, you know, pushed over by the wind itself. And then to have a day like today, where there is no wind at all, there's not a cloud in the sky, and the granite massif of Fitzroy just soars into a blue sky. It's just heaven. And I wouldn't want 24/7 of a beautiful weather day, because I also love the days when the wind is so strong or the rain is horizontal. It's just these extreme weather conditions that create and make what Patagonia is today with the landscape, and that there's less people living here. To me, that's what I love. And I know whenever anyone's coming over here, like when I've got family visiting, I always hope that they really get the four seasons in one day that we all talk about. But, you know, it's just, you realize how insignificant we are as human beings when, you know, you are attacked by nature down in Patagonia.
It sounds very similar to the Canadian Rockies, the way you describe it. And it's true, like the impact of extreme weather, it is kind of fun. You know, you're bundled up inside a cabin or a house and the wind's howling or snow's flying. It feels different than just kind of 24/7, you know, warm weather and sun. You mentioned earlier about how, you know, Chelten had changed since when you arrived. Are there other things that are changing in Patagonia that you've noticed in kind of the 15 years you've been there?
I think the main changes would be, I suppose, the local infrastructure. When I first arrived, all of the roads were gravel. All of the journeys were long. All of the journeys, you always had to make sure that you had extra water. in case a stone hit the radiator bursts, it loses water, engines overheat. So I always remember traveling with, you know, 20 liters of extra water in vehicles to make sure that, you know, you could resolve a problem. The buses in those days, the windscreens had like a metal, what do we call it? Richard, you're going to have to help me now with the English word. Sorry, pandemic. I've not really spoken English for 2 years and now I can't remember the words. What do we call it? Like barbed wire. So
a screen.
A screen just to stop the stones of the gravel roads breaking the windscreens. So now by having paved roads, to have mobile phone connection, I think it just means that we're a bit more connected with the rest of the world. I mean, when I first lived in here, you know, in the town, to have internet, we didn't have internet in the houses. There was a couple of internet cafes and it cost something like $20 for 15 minutes to get on the internet. And then probably in those 15 minutes, all you could do was, you know, check into your email account and never mind read an email. So to me, I think it's just now the contact with the rest of the world and just how technology has improved. And now, you know, we use WhatsApp and have communication. We can even do this podcast today, Richard. This, you know, a few years ago would have been absolutely impossible.
Yeah, I remember being in Chelten in 2003 and it was totally remote. You know, you'd go on Ruta 40 and like it felt like you were going someplace special. It seems from people I know have been there, it still is that special kind of remote place, but with more services. So you're not kind of out in the middle of nowhere. Let's talk a little bit about why people go to Chelten and why they go to Patagonia. What are some of the, you know, bucket list experiences that people come to Patagonia to experience?
One of them I think I've mentioned is the experience of the weather, but I think really what people want to see is Patagonia. They want to have the experience being like a pioneer, an adventurer in this place that we've read about through maybe adventurers of, I know Shackleton's a bit further south, but I mean, with stories of how Fitzroy and Darwin were in the area exploring. It's kind of like being in the footsteps of other Scandinavians that came down here initially to visit, to see some of these granite massifs that are in the Andes, the Fitzroy on the Argentinian side, the Torres del Paine on the Chilean. And it's just these amazing mountains, which are very accessible. They're a long way away from Europe, from Northern Hemisphere. But then when you're here, we don't have the problem of altitude. We don't really have problems with the food. So it's an area that people can come to at, you know, any time of life to enjoy the mountains, the walking, escape from technology and the stress of work, to go walking on glaciers. Luckily we're a Glaciares National Park and we still have glaciers. So I think it's the experience of seeing glaciers, being able to even go trekking on them and having these, you know, unique experiences we all have on our bucket lists.
So what's trekking like around Los Glaciares?
So the Glaciares National Park has actually got the town of Chelten located kind of, let's say, at the bottom of the mountains. It's actually at the bottom of a valley, which means that all of our trails do start with an uphill, as we do need to get out of the valley where Chelten's located. But then realistically, from the hotel, most people will be from the hotel within 10 minutes. They will actually be in the national park, surrounded by trees, wildlife, and just pure spectacular beauty and nature. People do day treks. Generally, it could be like trekking from like 5 kilometers to 20 kilometers. Either day trekking, some people would prefer to have a night over in Canvas to be, well, closer to the stars. By camping, people allow themselves to be in popular destinations at different times of the day. So, you know, when it is high season, the park is naturally busier. It does allow you to maybe be at Laguna de los Tres, which is at the foot of Fitzroy, when there's less people. So you then do feel just, you know, like this very small little person looking up at this awe-inspiring mountain and thinking how lucky you are that you can be there. That's kind of generally the more basic stuff. But then there are like longer treks, you know, that some people like to do who like to carry their larger pack, you know, with 15 kilos and actually go on more of like expedition style journeys to really explore more of the national park, to be able to see the continental ice field that lies between Chile and Argentina. So I think it's a great destination because there is something for everyone, from, you know, the person that's maybe more nervous to be in nature to the people who have got experience and really want to get off the beaten track.
If someone was coming and, you know, want to spend a week doing a difficult trek, where would you steer them? You know, what would you suggest is the trip they should consider?
We offer a 6-day trek that we call the Chalten Total, Total Chalten. And that allows you to do a little bit of everything. It allows you, you see probably about, I don't know, over 10 glaciers through the 6 days. You will walk through the different Nottafagos forests here. You'll see lots of different lagoons. You'll be crossing over a Tyrolean rope. You'll probably end up wading through a river. You'd see the continental ice field. You'd see a little bit of everything. And because it's 6 days, the great thing with that is you'll probably get the four seasons I'm talking about too. So you'll get to experience, you know, a little bit of everything that Patagonia offers. And you have more time with your guide. All of our guides are from here. And I think, you know, it's lovely to be able to build up a rapport with somebody who's from Argentina that talks about, you know, what Argentina is like. We all have interest, don't we, on other people's stories and lives. So having time with people for 6 days, it does give you time to get to know people and to learn more about the country that you're traveling in.
You know, I think that's such a good point. A big part of traveling is experiencing other cultures. And I really think when you work with a local tour operator, you get to understand what it's like for people that are living in that region. You get to understand more about the culture, the food, the people, but you also support the people and that are living in that region. And I always just think it's just such a better experience to have, you know, local guides. It just totally changes at least my experience. Now, when I was down in Chalten, I also spent some time in Torres del Paine, but I can't for the life of me remember how long it took to get from Chalten to Torres del Paine. It's obviously, you know, a really popular a place to go trekking in Chile. You know, is that something you see a lot of, that people, you know, like me come down and do kind of both the Chilean and the Argentinian side?
Yes, the journey you're talking about, Richard, that you would have done all those years ago when you were here, and the roads probably were still more gravel than they are today, between Calafate in Argentina and Puerto Natales in Chile. It's a 5-hour journey. It is a fantastic experience to get an idea of the distances, the remoteness, the fact that you don't really see any towns. So it just makes you, it gives you an idea of what it's like you were saying earlier, about living down here and realizing that, you know, you can't leave a town unless you're, you know, you've got a full tank of petrol, because otherwise, if you don't, you know, get to the next town, you're not going to get there. So it's a 5-hour journey really between the two towns. And then from Puerto Natales, it's an hour's journey more or less to Torres del Paine. What's slightly different with the Chilean side is there's not a town within the national park. So you either do the trekking like refuge to refuge, or you stay in like different hotels, which are on the edge of the national park. I think the great plus side with Chalten is you can stay in a hotel from a 1-star to a 5-star, and we've all got access to the trails from the same town. So the logistics are a lot easier for people on this side of the border. But I'm a fan of both sides of the border and the national parks. To me, it's all heavenly.
Yeah, no, it really is a special place, and definitely some place that, you know, everyone, if you like the outdoors, you know, should go there. We've talked a lot about trekking. I know we have a colleague here that, you know, her dream is to go horseback riding in Patagonia. There's also lots of, you know, the estancias. There's just driving tours. Can you maybe describe a few other, you know, popular kind of bucket list trips why people come down to Patagonia?
You're completely right. There's the trekking, which is probably what has made the area famous after the climbers that first came down to explore. And then Patagonia is full of these estancias, these humongous ranches, which used to be mainly for sheep and for cows, which was all meat that was then exported to Europe, mainly to the UK. And then a lot of these estancias, when the wool market went down in price, the estancias needed to kind of reinvent themselves. And that's when they ended up opening up to tourism. They opened up to tourism, which means that people can like just go and stay at an estancia, and you might just have contact with a little bit of the local gauchos, learn a little bit about their day-to-day activities. And then some of the estancias, they also organize the horse riding, and that can be like from a half a day to a day, or to even like a 4 or 5 day route. There's even some which are like crossing the Andes. There's all sorts of options depending on, you know, horse riding levels. And that to me is another, a complete other experience to be with gauchos in Patagonia, crossing over a steppe, going over a hill, suddenly seeing a glacier in front of you. It's just like, you know, one wow moment after another. So yeah, the horse riding to me is another important, interesting side of Patagonian life. That was the way people used to travel before there were vehicles. And road trips, they're also becoming more popular. I'm still nervous with the road trips because I just think it's important that people are aware that the winds are really strong. The roads are not particularly wide. And although one might have a lot of driving experience, I think driving in Patagonia was nothing like, you know, driving in London or Mexico City or in Alaska. I think, you know, it is another world. You've got a guanaco, you've got like a an animal that looks like a llama, the Patagonian version, that suddenly run across the road. And if you're not aware, then, you know, you're gonna hit that guanaco. So to me, the road trips are amazing, but we do a lot of them actually with guides because we also feel that sometimes it's great to, again, to learn about what you're looking at or to understand why all of the ranches have got all of the same tall trees. You know, why were they planted there? Because they're not trees that are from this area originally. To understand a bit about the logistics. I mean, now we all get to places via airports, but Patagonia, you know, you didn't fly in here before. You know, you got a boat down from Buenos Aires and you went down the Atlantic coast and everything happened from the coast towards the Andes. So I think it is just interesting, you know, to have this contact to kind of make people really think about how Patagonia was and how it is today to understand it better.
You mentioned the roads and the winds, and you're thinking, oh, you know, it's difficult in a car, but I've been to a few talks about people who've cycled, you know, from Ushuaia all the way up to Alaska. And they're like, you know, they talk about the winds, you know, you kind of struggle, you know, to think about them. But then it's like, if they're trouble on a car, just imagine what it's like trying to cycle up, you know, one of these roads where the cars are being blown off. It just must be a nightmare.
To give you an idea, Richard, there's the journey from Calafate to Chalten. The last 100 kilometers is on a straight road east to west. So it's against the wind. Now, if the winds are strong, that journey, which should take, let's say, you know, 100 kilometers an hour, it could take you double that because you can't get anywhere near a normal speed because the winds are so, so strong. And how do you describe that? How can I get that across to you unless you come down here and try and do that journey? It is crazy. And the people on the bikes that day, they just have to say, right, it's a rest day today. And they'll just sleep and catch up with their blogs and stuff. But they're not going to be able to go out and cycle in it unless they really have to. Because, yeah, you'd be cycling backwards rather than forwards.
Actually, a rest day in those winds and you're in some, you know, little ultralight tent definitely doesn't sound like a great day off. You mentioned earlier about how people used to get to Patagonia. I know one thing that surprises people is just how remote it is. So if people are thinking, hey, this sounds great, you know, they're in the UK or North America, you know, what's the journey most people take to get down to Patagonia?
How long is the journey from Canada to Buenos Aires, Richard?
When I did it, I got the budget ticket. So I was doing a milk run. I think I had like 5 stops. I think now it's 14 hours. It's surprisingly long, you know, because my family, we were looking at doing it. It's surprisingly long to get to Buenos Aires and then it's from there. So I think it's 14 hours from Western Canada to Buenos Aires.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, that's what I was going to say. To me, most journeys are going to be probably 10 hours and above just to get to Buenos Aires. And then from Buenos Aires, you've got another 3-hour flight down to Calafate. And from there, if you're going to go straight to Chalten, you're going to have another just over 200 kilometers, 2.5-hour, 3-hour journey to get to Chalten. So the journeys are long, which is why we always kind of like say, you know, either have time or try to do not too many places on the same trip, because otherwise you do spend a lot of your time just sitting on buses or on planes. I think it's interesting to think with Argentina to travel like right from the north of the country to the south in a plane, it would take you 6 hours and that's all in one country. So that's the way I try and make people understand, because we're all used to now flying, you know, that, yeah, 6 hours. I mean, I think in Europe, if you do 6 hours, you've crossed over most of the countries of Europe, never mind, you know, stayed in just one. So it is a humongous country. I mean, the border between Chile and Argentina is over 5,000 kilometers long. So they are both large countries. Chile's a little bit skinnier than Argentina. But yeah, there's a lot of Andes and there's a lot of mountains and a lot of trekking and nature and outdoors because of that. But it does mean you want to have time to be able to enjoy it when you arrive.
And, you know, you mentioned going to Buenos Aires, like that's a great, you know, one thing that's really nice if it's your first trip. So, you know, you land in Buenos Aires, spend a couple days exploring, then catch your flight down to Patagonia on the way back, spend another couple days. You know, it makes it a really incredible trip. You probably need 2 weeks to, you know, at the minimum, to really just get a feel for this. More time is better. But also, when's the best time to go? You know, I went in the middle of you know, the Southern Hemisphere summer. But do people go kind of in the off season? You know, what's it like to be in Chalten in spring or autumn or winter?
To me, I mean, Patagonia is fantastic all year round. What is worth, I think, just bearing in mind is a bit like, you know, if you're in Northern Canada, the daylight hours in the winter are a lot shorter. So it does mean that your holiday becomes shortened on what, you know, what you can do during the day. So to me, in a way, the spring and the autumn months are great because they are more like shoulder seasons. They are, there's people, everything is still running, but there are less people. If you come in the springtime, what you then have are all of the spring flowers, all of the trees beginning to turn, you know, green, turn into bloom. If you come in autumn, it's generally when we have a lot of photographers that like to come in the autumn time because all of the trees here, they lose their leaves. But before they lose them, we just have the fantastic autumnal colors. So, you know, to see whole glacial valleys just suddenly turn to all sorts of different hues of orange and red and like just the colors of fire and, you know, the sun shines on them and it is just absolutely stunning. Then you have a little bit of a snowfall and it is just, you know, blue sky, snow-capped mountains and red valleys. It is heavenly. So in a way, I like that time of the year. The plus side with the summer is that everything's alive. In December and January, that's when all of the guanacos, all of the animals have all just had their young. So you can hear, you know, the woodpeckers chirruping, the little ones in the trees. You're more likely to see the woodpeckers. They're more active as they, you know, they're looking for food for the young. And the days are so much longer. So suddenly, you know, when you've got 18 hours of daylight, there's so much you can do, you know, that you kind of need a holiday from your holiday because you feel you just do stuff all the time, you know, you forget to kind of stop. But, you know, when it's still daylight, you know, full daylight, 6-7 o'clock, you kind of think, oh, let's go and do this. And then suddenly you think, oh, I'm really hungry. Why is that? And yeah, the days are long, but I'm sure you can understand that in Canada.
Yeah, definitely. No, in summer, I almost welcome winter because it just allows, you know, kind of slowing down, you know, the sun rises at 8, it goes down at 4:30. It's kind of nice, just, you know, days, life's a bit simpler in winter. So last question, obviously people are always wondering what's happening with the COVID situation in terms of, you know, people going to Argentina. Are there any special precautions right now? Is it, you know, getting easier?
So at the moment, the Argentinian government is asking for everyone to have had 2 vaccines prior to arrival, and the second vaccine must be over a fortnight from the day of arrival into Argentina. You must have a negative PCR test 72 hours prior to arrival, and there is a form online that you have to fill in, again also before arrival, which basically is just informing the government about which vaccine you received, what date you received it, all of your details. Nothing complicated, but it's just, you know, taking the time to fill the information in. Then on arrival, people will be expected to wear face masks. That's still mainly happening in the cities, like in Buenos Aires. In Buenos Aires, you know, it's still, you know, it's a city. It feels more like where there's more COVID, etc. Down here in Patagonia, to be honest, in Chalten, last week there was one case, but there aren't any cases now. So I think the great thing with Patagonia now is because we're all outdoors, then, you know, it is kind of quite an easy, safe place to travel. people do wear a face mask again on the buses for traveling and on the planes, but it is becoming slowly more and more relaxed.
And that's, you know, that sounds great. I know Patagonia or Argentina as a whole was, you know, a lot of South America had really, you know, heavy restrictions. It seems now like it's like traveling anywhere. There are some hoops to jump through, but it's no different from other locations, which is great because it's just in time for the summer season for you down in the Southern Hemisphere.
I think the only thing to bear in mind still, Richard, is actually the land border between Chile and Argentina and Patagonia is still not open. So if anyone on a bucket list is traveling kind of in the next 2 or 3 months, then I think they'd have to choose between Chile or Argentina. And if they really want to do both, you know, I think it's worth waiting a few more months until that border is definitely open. There's a lot of cases in Magallanes on the Chilean side, and that's why they've chosen not to open up yet to the land border. It might happen tomorrow, it might happen in 2 months. So that's the only thing I'm kind of slightly aware of, that, you know, you don't want someone on their bucket list to come and then not be able to do half of their trip.
The only thing that's certain about the pandemic is uncertainty. And as you say, some all of a sudden one day things change and it's like, oh, this is great, or oh, this is a wrench in my plans. You know, Zoe, thanks for coming on the podcast today. I loved hearing about, you know, Patagonia, and, you know, as you're talking, my mind as reliving, you know, my time there, and it brought back so many good memories. So thanks for sharing, you know, all this information. And I'm going to put in the show notes some links to some of the places and trips Zoe talked about. So if you're interested in getting some more information, by all means, check that out. And Zoe, hopefully, you know, we can meet up in person at one of the future Adventure Travel Trade Association events as, you know, life continues to get back to normal.
Exactly. Otherwise, I will see you down here or anyone else that's listening to enjoy a glass of Malbec, the Argentinian wine. We can't forget about that. And share all of our adventures, stories about other places in the world where we've all had great holidays. So, yeah, great to be in touch again, Richard, and look forward to the next one.
Excellent. Thanks a lot.
Okay, bye.
We hope you enjoyed this episode of the 10 Adventures podcast. If you liked it, why not give us a review? Better yet, subscribe and get inspired again and again. Also, if you want to find your own adventures, why not check out 10adventures.com, where you can use our free resources to plan your own trip or book a tour in over 60 countries and make your own epic memories on your next adventure.